Okay, I'd like to call the session of the House Resources Committee to order. It is March 25th, 2024. We are located in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, Representative Wright, Representative Baker, Representative Rauscher, and myself, Chair Tom McKay. We have a quorum to do business. I'd like to thank the staff, Zach, Justin, and Rose today for helping us run the meeting. And just a reminder to everyone to please keep your cell phones on silent. We have three items on today's agenda. The first is House Bill 295, Salmon Hatchery Permits. This is our second hearing in House Resources Committee. We'll deal with at least one amendment and hopefully have the move forward to move the bill out of committee. Second thing is a presentation by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska by Becky Alvey, who happens to be with us today. Welcome, Becky. And then the third thing is House Bill 359, the one-time PFD payment. This is our third hearing in House Resources. So let's get right to it. Item one, House Bill 295, Salmon Hatchery Permits. I bring the bill before the committee, and I have proposed one amendment, and I will move Amendment 1.
To Jack, purpose discussion.
And Representative Rauscher objects for discussion. So I will read the description of Amendment 1. This is Chair McKay. This amendment is being introduced largely in response to the public testimony we heard last week, highlighting an issue with the House Fisheries Committee substitute of HB 295, specific to Section 2 of the bill. This amendment would remove Section 2 entirely. While the purposes for Section 2 may or may not have merit, it would appear that the section certainly has unintended consequences. The concern that hatchery fish may be having an impact on wild runs at sea is real. Whether or not we can yet quantify the extent of that impact. My concern with Section 2 of this bill is that it could have removed a well-established public process, the Board of Fish, from the oversight of hatchery production and would have removed the public's voice from how we use the commons of the ocean. By removing this section, we're not condemning hatcheries. We're simply maintaining the public processes that have worked for the last 40 years. Any questions or comments on Amendment 1? Hearing none, do you remove your objection, Representative Rauscher?
Mr. Chairman, I remove my objection.
Is there any further objection? Hearing none, Amendment 1 is adopted. So, Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion for House Bill 295?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to report the committee substitute for HB 295, Work Order 33GH2383/S, as amended, from the committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authority for legal services services to make technical and conforming changes.
Hearing no objection, the motion is adopted and the bill is moved out of committee. So we will take a brief of these to sign the committee report. Okay, calling the House Resources Committee back to order. We now move to our second topic today, a presentation by the RCA, otherwise known as the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I'd like to introduce Becky Alvey to our committee today. She's the Advisory Section Manager for the RCA. We asked the RCA to be here today in light of House Bill 394, introduced by the... I need a little bit of light to read. In light of House Bill 394, introduced by the House Resources Committee, dealing with gas storage, my office will be presenting this bill in the next week or so, but we wanted to give everyone some good background information in preparation. Becky Alvey, will you come forward and put yourself on the record, and please begin your presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Becky Alvey. I'm the Advisory Section Manager of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. In this presentation, I'm just going to give you an overview of the RCA and kind of our current natural gas storage and how we deal with that. Prior to the Alaska Public Utilities Commission Act, the utilities were regulated by the Alaska Public Service Commission in 1970. The Alaska Public Utilities Commission Act established the APUC, or the Alaska Public Utilities Commission. The Alaska Pipeline Commission was established to regulate intrastate pipeline, and it was merged with the APUC in 1981. In 1999, the legislature replaced the APUC with the RCA, which is who we currently are. The commission performs quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative functions. It's comprised of four main sections, a commission section with five commissioners who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature, consumer protection staff, a number of support sections. We have an administrative law section, which is administrative law judges and paralegals. The advisory section, which is the section that I oversee, which is comprised of tariffs, engineering and financial analysts, and then communication specialists. And then our last section is the utility master analysts.
Okay, Becky, Representative Rauscher has a question, please.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. Through the chair. Appreciate your testimony. So basically in 1970, you said that the Alaska Public Utilities Commission was created to replace the APSC. And then you said later on, 99, Alaska legislature replaced the APUC. Have any of their responsibilities changed with all of this redesignation or renaming or reorganizing? Do you know if the responsibilities of these organizations have changed over the years?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, overall, no. APUC, when it was first created, only dealt with the utilities. And then at the point that the Pipeline Commission and the APUC were merged, we regulated utilities and the pipelines. Some of the responsibilities since the APUC have kind of been expanded as things have changed through legislature. But overall, it's still been our primary goal to and directive to regulate the utilities and pipeline.
Follow-up, Representative Rauscher.
So has the costs incurred to keep the organization moving grown over the years, or is it basically the same, just cost of living?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, some of the costs have grown. There was a bill, Senate Bill 123, that was enacted in 2020 that included five utility master analyst positions. And so there have been, that's the most recent one that I know of where it has changed for our costs. We do our budget every year, and most of the costs depend on the amount of also items that we have to take care of, whether it's regulatory or the other, just reviewing utility filings and some of those things.
And one last follow-up.
Representative Rauscher.
To the chair. So I was just wondering, are all positions filled at this point? I know some of the departments don't have all the positions filled. I was just wondering, are, you know, is this particular organization, are they all filled?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, no, we do have a number of vacancies in our agency. Currently, we have only 4 of the 5 commissioners. And I know within my own section, we have about 7 open vacant positions.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Ms. Salvey, please continue.
Sure. The commission was created by statute and is required by statute to regulate public utilities, which is found under AS 4205, and pipeline carriers, which is found under AS 4206 and AS 4208. The commission is also required by statute to determine the per cost or per kilowatt hour support for eligible customers of electric utilities under the PCE program, which we administer with the Alaska Energy Authority. Most recently in our statutory changes, which I've listed here and I broke out separately, was the creation of the Electric Reliability Organization, and that was Senate Bill 123. Our statutes define public utility. Specific to today's discussion regarding natural gas, G and H of this statute pertain to natural gas storage and liquefied natural gas storage to the public for compensation. These different categories, so electric, telecom, water, this is what in our statute defines a public utility. Alaska statutes AS 4205 and AS 4206 authorize the RCA to certificate qualified providers of public utility and pipeline service. A certificate may not be issued unless the RCA finds that the applicant is fit, willing, and able, and that services are required for the convenience and necessity of the public. We'll note, as kind of a caveat, AS 4206 does not provide that the pipeline carrier has to be fit. It just has to be willing and able. However, the commission has evaluated applications for pipelines using the same parameters that we use for utilities, which are financial, managerial, technical ability, and fitness. This slide demonstrates the number of utility certificates that the commission currently has active, which is 588 utilities, 25 pipeline carriers, and 1 electric reliability organization.
Can you hold up, Ms. Salvey? Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the utility regulations are a complicated subject, and there's a lot of terminology. But through the chair, Ms. Salvey, so not rate regulated versus rate regulated. Just help me understand why one, and provisionally, yeah, help me understand the distinction and why some are and some are not.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sadler. So, and it's going to get a little bit into it in the next slide. If a utility is rate regulated, then we set their rates. If they're not rate regulated, then they can change their rates without the commission's authority or approval of those rates. We have, for small water and wastewater systems, we've also established provisional certifications, and this is typically with homeowners associations or some of the rural villages will also be provisionally certificated, and the standard for provisional certification is not quite as high as the standard for typical regular certification or formal certification. Additionally, there is a number of exemptions under AS 4205-711, which would provide why a utility would not be regulated by the commission.
Okay.
Please continue. We may come back to this, but please, maybe we'll let you get through them and then we can ask more questions.
So this slide kind of goes through our core services. We certificate utilities and pipeline carriers and determine if they're fit, willing, and able. We review tariff filings made by the utilities and pipeline carriers that seek to change their rates or their terms. The commission ensures that rates by the utilities are just and reasonable and their rate services and practices abide by their filed tariffs. We investigate complaints regarding utility service, quality, billing, management practices, etc., And then we calculate the power cost equalization amounts for each regulated and non-regulated participating electric utility, in addition to calculating the PCE annual base rate, which is also referred to as the PCE floor. And so here's the slide regarding utilities that are exempt from rate regulation. This kind of lists out a number. This includes utilities that are owned by a political subdivision of the state, some of these small water and sewer communities like or utilities. If refuse utilities that don't gross more than $300,000 annually are exempt. And most of these are all listed in AS4205711. There is kind of a carve out of for commercial refuse in the municipality of Anchorage and then the Fairbanks, Mat-Su and Kenai boroughs. We don't rate regulate commercial refuse, and that was from an order in 2007. And so they can also adjust their rates without coming in to see us. And then cable, internet, wireless, and right now telephone is also pretty much not regulated other than inmate calling. The commission has the ability under statute to also grant exemptions if it is in the public interest.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Ms. So cable, internet, wireless, and telephone, can I presume that the state does not regulate, that the RCA does not regulate those because there's federal regulation on those? Is that a fair assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
Okay. And if I may follow up,
follow up, Representative.
My curiosity is piqued. Where might the commission have found that exemption was in the public interest? Is there an example of that, you know? Just kind of trivia, but
through the chair, Representative Sadler, not off the top of my head. I can definitely look. Gotcha. I think we've done it for a smaller electric utility.
Okay, please continue.
Okay. So this slide kind of goes through some of our tariff review process. One of the main functions that the commission does is tariff review. Staff analyzes filings to determine if rates are just and reasonable, if the tariff provisions are reasonable and supported. This kind of, as I said, goes through our process. An entity would make a tariff filing with us. Frequently, that is publicly noticed for comment. As listed, there's a number of review periods. Typically, it's 45 days for the utility. And then prior to the end of that review period, the commission will approve, reject, or suspend the filing. If the commission does not take action within those timelines, then those filings take effect by force of law, which is something that we do try to avoid. If a tariff filing is suspended into the docket for further investigation, we assign a commission panel and an administrative law judge. We may invite participation from the Attorney General, the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy Section, or RAPA, and interested parties. We'll hold evidentiary hearings when applicable, and then we'll issue our final order. And our timelines for that issuance of final order are set out in AS42-175. And I've put two of them up here. So within 450 days, if it changes the revenue requirement or rate design, so typically what we also call a rate case, or within 270 days for a change that's something other than a revenue requirement study. Another kind of large item that the commission handles is the PCE program. Under the PCE program, the state pays a portion of the electric bills for consumers served by the utilities that participate in this program. The commission establishes the PCE amount in a cents per kilowatt hour applicable to each utility, regardless if the utility is otherwise subject to regulation. Right now, we have 11 regulated utilities and 78 non-regulated utilities that participate in the PCE program, which impacts more than 150 communities. We set the PCE base rate, which here on the slide cites the statute, but this is the weighted average retail residential rate of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. But it is set subject to the statutory ceiling, which is a dollar. The PCE program is administered by Alaska Energy Authority. So the commission sets the rate, and the NAEA is one of their functions, just makes the payment disbursements. So with this, in the next couple slides, I'm going to discuss natural gas storage in Alaska. In December 2009, Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, LLC, or SIGS, filed a petition asking the RCA to determine that the RCA did not have jurisdiction over SIGS' proposed natural gas storage facility. In the final order in those dockets, the commission found that the RCA's statutes did not provide explicit authority to regulate gas storage, nor did they definitively set natural gas storage outside of the RCA's jurisdictional boundaries. The RCA declined to issue a declaratory ruling in those dockets. However,
Ms. Alvey, Representative McCabe has a question.
Thanks. So I'm sorry, I wanted to get to you before we got into the natural gas. So I have a couple of questions. We were talking about employees, and I'm wondering about you have a pretty large employee shortage right now. Like 4 of 5 analysts are gone.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe.
Master analysts?
We currently, out of the 5 utility master analysts, we have 1 of those positions filled, and so we have 4 that are not. And then for the common carrier tariff, engineering, and finance, we have about 6 positions that are not. Filled.
Thanks. Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up, Representative McCabe.
So I haven't seen any of those advertised, any of the master analyst positions advertised, and not something that I pay a huge amount of attention to, but where would you normally advertise those? And I'm also wondering why all of a sudden, prior to COVID, this seems like a really good agency to work for. I never heard of any huge amount of vacancies, but now all of a sudden we have large 11-20 people vacant and 4 out of 5 master analysts gone and 6 of the would you say they were tariff analysts?
Through the chair, they were tariff, engineering, finance, and common carrier, so telecom.
So these seem to be
McCabe.
These seem to be pretty significant positions. Probably takes a while to get them trained up. And where'd they all go and why'd they leave? And how are we going to get them back?
Through the chairs, Representative McCabe. So we advertised for positions on Workplace Alaska. I know that they had advertised for 1 of the utility master analysts not that long ago. We've had a few kind of internal moves in the agency. At least speaking for myself, I was previously over the tariff section as their supervisor, and then I've been in the role as the advisory section manager since September. I was an acting status before that, so like my previous position has not been filled. I know we're working on filling several of the other open positions.
Follow up, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. And these have been vacant for a while. I think you're at like a 25% vacancy rate. So all the money that would normally go to those PCNs is coming back to the general fund, right?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I believe so, but I don't know off the top of my head.
More rhetorical than anything. Thanks.
Please proceed, Ms. Alvey.
So after 2009, in January 2010, House Bill 280, also known as the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, was introduced. And this bill, as it relates to the RCA, added in new subsections in our statute related to natural gas storage, the approval of gas contracts, and provided for exemptions of certain natural gas storage facilities, which they're listed here. They're on the North Slope, or they're part of a pipeline or natural gas pipeline facility. And then in July 2010, Governor Sean Parnell signed the Cook Recovery Act into law, which is kind of where we started regulating natural gas storage. We currently have 2 certificated natural gas storage facilities, Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Alaska LLC, or CINGSA, and then Interior Alaska Natural Gas Utility. CINGSA is economically regulated. INGU, so Interior, is owned by the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, which is a political subdivision of the state and therefore exempt from regulation under AS 4205711B. Just for note, Interior provides liquid natural gas storage versus CINGSA, which provides just natural gas storage.
And then, okay, so yeah, at the risk of saying it wrong, IANGU is owned by ADA, and then NSTAR owns CINGSA? Or do I have that wrong?
Chairman McKay, no, that is correct. The INGU is owned by ADA, and then Cook Inlet, so CINGSA and NSTAR are, my understanding, subsidiaries, and then they have the same parent company. But there's a lot of the same kind of, there's some similar staff.
Okay.
So a little bit more about CINGSA. They provide natural gas storage. They were certificated in 2011. And they receive, inject, store, withdraw, and deliver natural gas. They're economically regulated, which means that they are subject to AS 4205 and the Alaska Administrative Code, Title III, which is applicable to utilities, specifically Chapters 47 and 48. The rules and rates are set out in CINGSA's tariff, and any changes to those rules or rates are filed as tariff filings and subject to approval by the RCA. CINGSA files, in addition, firm storage service agreements and interruptible storage agreements. Those agreements will set out the terms of their storage. In addition, CINGSA currently has 5 wells in operation, and we recently approved an expansion agreement that would add 2 additional wells. That was in the last couple of months.
Do you know, this is Chair McKay, do you know when those 2 additional wells will be drilled and completed? And I assume that they would be permitted by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
Chair McKay, that the 2 wells, I believe their filing said 2025. I can double check, okay. And I can definitely get back to you on a definite. Okay. They would be permitted by AOGCC. And
okay.
Otherwise, I'm open for other questions.
Okay, I got Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for coming today. I am still trying to wrap my head around a little bit what goes into the filings for natural gas storage. What are your inputs? What are the decisions that are being made there?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, it depends a little bit of what they're filing. If CINGSA is making a filing that is going to just change the rules in their tariff, they would make a tariff filing with those rule changes and some supporting documentation or any support in their tariff advice letter for that. If they're changing their rates, they're subject to all the rest of the utilities that file the NR regulation. There is a list of items, like balance sheets and pro forma adjustments for rate setting. And then for their contracts, it's another tariff filing with a contract that they've entered into with an entity. I will note that for their firm storage, those are ones that come in and are approved, and then they're interruptible ones. They just file with us informationally. But it would be any of these tariff filings who would have a tariff advice letter explaining the change and then supporting documentation in support of the change. If it was a rate and the commission, so staff will generally ask questions if they need additional information before it's presented to the commission. And then if the commission determines to suspend it, then we kind of, there's parties, then they usually get a little bit more information out even after that.
Follow up,
Rep. Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. So are there kind of 2 basic buckets that I'm pulling out here? It's kind of overseeing contracts to make sure the terms are meeting the public's needs as well as the rates.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, there's I guess we could say three buckets. There's rules, there's rates, and then there's contracts. And all of those would be reviewed are they in the public interest? Are they just and reasonable?
Okay, I didn't know if you were finished. All right, another follow-up, Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Could you talk a little bit more about what rules encompasses?
Through the chair, Representative Mears. So rules would be any of their terms of service and I'm trying to think through SINGSA's tariff kind of in my brain, of specifically any of the definitions, like sets out what is a customer, what is firm storage. They'll have rules about the different, if there's a rate applicable, when, if any sort of, and I'm thinking in general utilities, if there's complaints. So like an electric utility would have kind of in their connections and line extensions and different policies for how they're interacting, basically the rules that they're using with their customers. Occasionally it's referred to as like the tariff is kind of the contract with the customer, but that tariff will set out all of their rules for how the interaction with the customer kind of works, billing deposits, et cetera.
Okay, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I'm kind of stuck on customers. I think so. I'm aware that AFN passed a resolution in October of last year calling for the investigation of the RCA and why it appears that you are not serving your customers in rural Alaska very well. Are you aware of that resolution?
Through the chair, Representative McKay. Sorry. I am aware of that resolution from AFN.
So have we done anything? Has the RCA done anything to mitigate the, I don't know, they say, in fact, I could read it. It says a resolution calling for the state of Alaska to investigate the operations of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska that causes rural residents undue financial hardships that affect their ability to thrive. So, I just want to read that into the record and get your take on what the RCA is doing to mitigate what AFN thinks you have done to them. Done to them is the wrong word, but, you know, haven't served them very well, apparently, according to them. So,
through the chair, Representative McCabe, the commission, as a result of things that happened prior to AFN, has looked a lot into some of its internal processes and internal noticing. Recently, the commission had voted to open a regulations docket to relook at noticing to try to ensure that the commission, that customers are getting effective public notice of rate changes and things. And so mostly there has been a lot of internal discussion of trying to get and some of the procedures and things kind of nailed down so that we do make sure that we are doing what we need to for rural Alaska.
Follow up, Rep. McCabe.
One more follow up. Thanks. So this kind of sticks on the personnel thing. You have a finance 1-2 position. That's an issue. Has it been removed? There seems to be a lot of personnel issues that you're dealing with right now that are affecting the RCA's ability to do its business. Frankly, I tried to use the RCA over a year ago. The results I got were problematic to me. And I think we're paying the commissioners $137,000 a year. And I assume we're paying a pretty decent price for the employees. And I'm wondering why we are not getting, and the AFN, the natives and the villagers are not getting the results. I mean, somewhere back in here, he said it took 450 days to get a result. That's a year and a half. I mean, that's a long time to before you publish a result. So I'm very concerned that this commission's not doing what it was designed to do. The information I got on the why is the finance 1-2 position been removed after being held for 7 years as a necessary position. Why would it be removed when it's purported the employee who has been calculating PCE, which is the village's, for the past 10 years at the commission, he's planning to retire? What's your plans to replace him? How long will it take to train him? I mean, all these kinds of things are very, very important to our rural residents who rely on the PCE and rely on that calculation. It seems to me the RCA is the single point of failure here, and we're going down a path that that maybe we don't want to go. So I guess the question for me is, what can we do to help you fix this?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I know for at least one of the items that you listed, we are looking, we're working to recruit on that PCE for and doing some internal cross-training for staff so that we can continue to make sure that everything with PCE continues to be administered. I don't have an answer exactly off the top of my head about additional things that the legislature could do for some.
Well, Salvi, let me try to help here a little bit. Can you go back to one of the first slides that had the pictures of the commissioners? So I didn't really see an org chart, but where do you fit in? You have five commissioners. They're the bosses, right? And then you're underneath those guys?
The Chairman McKay, yes, I am.
Okay, so we're going to have one of them or several of them come in and testify. Mr. Jepson, can you answer that for me? We're going to have these, because I'm a little bit concerned that maybe Ms. Alvey is not at the level of management where she could definitively answer some of these pretty difficult questions. So we will get those answers from the gentleman in these pictures. Okay? Representative McCabe, is that fair enough?
Fair enough. Thanks.
Okay.
Not meaning to attack you, I'm getting a bunch of questions from folks who are concerned that the RCA is not being as helpful as I think was imagined when we first put it in statute. Your mandate is kind of to help us. And so.
Okay, Representative Sadler had a question.
Thank you. I was going to ask questions, but I think Representative McCabe has covered that topic well. So my question through the chair to Ms. Alvey is, I was going to say the RCA does have a significant, energy is important and the cost of energy cascades throughout our economic system. So my question to you is, can RCA, under current statutes at least, consider anything other than financial considerations and public, in setting rates? I know in years past there were some decisions on rate cases in Cook Inlet that might have had a different outcome for the state's economy. So can RCA set a higher than minimum cost for natural gas in the interest of incentivizing more production, or is that kind of policy decision outside the authority given to you by statute?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. So by statute, it discusses just and reasonable rates. The commission is, we're kind of bound to our statutes. However, if a filing came before us, the commission would look to see if it is also in the public interest.
And follow up, Rep. Sadler.
And thank you. Just, I guess, to scope the question, definition of words, the great maximum public benefit in the public interest. How broadly is in the public interest defined? The thought being that if we cannot supply gas at a real low cost, can we say, well, it's important that Alaskans have gas? Can we authorize and approve a rate case that has a higher price per MCF if it is considered in the public interest? I guess I'm just trying to probe how much discretion RCA has to help us address our gas shortage, which is not exactly what you want to talk about gas storage, but it's kind of related.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the NSTAR, and the electric utilities that use natural gas, so we regulate them. However, the producers and most of the gas utilities that are selling gas, so Hillcorp and Fury, we don't regulate. The utility will enter in a contract with the producer or that gas supplier, and then that contract comes before the commission. And we do review those and approve those. And it is, you know, if it's in the public interest, I would say most recently, you know, we're looking at, there's several of the utilities that are looking, that currently have, that are buying gas for electric production that's in the about 750 range. Whereas Homer Electric just recently had a contract approved that was gas over $8. And so Homer still needs the gas. And so the contract was approved. And so I think the commission is sensitive to the fact that gas prices are potentially going to rise and that we're going to see those. And as we look through contracts, we're going to look and see what is the interest of, because obviously the utilities are still going to need gas.
Follow up, Rep. Sadler.
Yeah, but, again, it's a deep pool. I hate to wade in it. But so it sounds like you're saying that the RCA does consider the cost of supply in evaluating and improving the rates among the utilities.
Through the chair, yes. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes. The commission does consider kind of the number of factors when we look at those, including is it going to be one of those, is the utility going to still be able to provide service?
And if I may probe a little bit more.
So, all right, one more, Representative Sadler.
And I guess I'll just say, is it conceivable that if the RCA did not approve a rate case because it thought the price of the gas was too high, could that distort the market? I mean, if RCA, in my words, made a mistake or miscalculated, could that be a cap which would distort the ability of consumers in South Central to actually receive gas at any price? In other words, if RCA said, no, we think that $8 in MCF is too much, we'll only approve $5, and the producer said, well, I'm not going to do it at that price, could that distort things and make it uneconomic for producers to sell their gas to a utility?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, as we don't regulate the producers, I think the utilities are going to come in with the contracts. I can tell you a number of years ago, there's a long-term contract with MLNP when Municipal Light and Power was still, before it was acquired by Shugach. And they had a long-term contract where even before gas was getting into the $8-$9 on MCF, their contract gas for that time period was like $9.25 at the end of the life of the contract. The commission still had approved that contract to ensure that there was natural gas for the utility. So mostly to answer your question, I believe that as filings are made and there is the as the utilities come in with a contract that is going to still be in the public's interest, where that's going to still be considered as gas prices move.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, Ms. Alva, if you wouldn't mind. On slide 7, I'd just like to ask, I'll take an easy one first. Right in the middle of the page, natural gas storage utilities, there's two of them. One is rate regulated, one is not rate regulated. So I guess the rate regulated would be CINGSA.
Chairman McKay, yes.
Is that correct? That's correct. And then who's?
That's Interior Alaska Natural Gas Utility.
Oh, okay. We already covered that. Okay. That's the IAN.
GU, yes.
GU. And then it says natural gas utilities, there's 8 right above that, and it's 4 and 4. So I guess who are the 4 that you would regulate?
Chairman McKay, so NSTAR, Doyon, Norgasco, and the 4th one is slipping my brain.
Okay, that's all right. That happens to me a lot. And then the 4 that are not regulated, is that a big deal, or who might they be?
Chairman McKay, off the top of my head, I can tell you Fairbanks Natural Gas. Is not, okay. Is that part of, it's also owned by, I believe, ADA.
Okay. And then at the very top, the electric utilities, that would be, I guess, Chugach, MEA.
So in our regulated, sorry.
There's 33 of them. There's quite a few.
Chair McKay, so the regulated utilities, so Chugach, MEA, HEA, GVA, And then we get an AELNP here in Juneau, and then we get into some of the rural utilities, G&K, Gwich'izi.
Okay.
I could probably.
That's all right. So let's take an example. If I build a, let's say I build a combination solar farm, wind farm, and I'm going to sell electric into the grid, would you regulate my operation? And would you tell me what I can charge or not charge?
So, Chair McKay, for small renewables, if they fall under PURPA, there is usually an interconnection agreement with the utility, and they are selling that power to the utility. And the utility would file with us that interconnection and integration, and there's generally a rate associated with that that the commission would approve. Currently, right now, there's a number of small IPPs or independent power producers that are selling about at the avoided cost of avoided cost rate for what it's the cost that the utility would avoid by purchasing that power instead of generating it themselves.
Avoided costs. That sounds like not good. Well, it has a negative connotation. All right. Let's take a simple example. I'm producing gas in Cook Inlet, and I want to – it's summertime, so I need to put it in CINGSA. So I sell it to NSTAR, and NSTAR injects it into CINGSA, and they pay me for that gas. And that's there's a transaction at that point, financial transaction by contract that you guys – that RCA approves. Sure. And then – in the wintertime, it gets cold, NSTAR needs to draw out of CINGSA. They've already paid for that gas, so they just move it on to the consumers. Is that basically how it works?
Yes, Chair McKay.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, I think the reason why we're studying this is because this is going to be very important to what we do going forward on Cook Inlet gas so that everybody understands how this works. And then the other avenue is they don't go to CINGSA. They just go directly, they produce it right out of the wells and Cook Inlet right to NSTAR and right into the transmission system.
Chair McKay, yes, that's correct. They'll either, whether it's for NSTAR or if it's one of the utilities, it's either going to go to a plant or out into the distribution system, or it's going to get injected into storage.
So that happens often. There's contracts probably quite often that get updated or renegotiated, and every time RCA has to approve those gas sale contracts between the producer and the gas utility. Every time.
Chair McKay, yes.
Okay, so
in any
trying to get a feel for how often does the RCA challenge, is it kind of a rubber stamp, like, yep, looks good, or is there a lot of pushback? Maybe you can't answer that. I know it's kind of an arbitrary question, but I think we're trying to get a feel for how deep do you question the prices that get agreed to in these contracts? Are you got the staff, the technical crew, the people that can understand what's going on in the industry where you can definitively say, yep, it looks good, or no, you're charging too much, or if you're charging too little? I guess that would never happen, but
Chairman,
making sense?
It does make sense. So staff would look at, as the contracts come in and during their review, and some of that is questions back and forth, as far as some of the contracts, the utility is negotiating with the producer at a rate that that they've agreed to. Staff will still investigate or still review those, and the commission may have additional questions before it finds it in the public interest, as we're required by statute to ensure that a gas contract is in the public interest.
So if we get in a position sooner or later where we're importing LNG, let's say at Nikiski, just for an example, would RCA be involved in that, approving that contract price for the LNG that's coming in?
Chair McKay, we would, if it was one of the, if it was a price between, say, NSTAR and the LNG import, they would come in with what that price is in those contracts.
And but then, you probably wouldn't be able to say too much because it's a tanker load of LNG purchased on the world market. So you probably wouldn't be able to really argue with it. It'd probably show you the invoice and say, here's how much we paid for it. And that's it, right? I mean, I'm just thinking, like, you're going to pay what you're going to pay, right?
So Chair McKay, I believe, well, and
sorry if
I completely answer your question. If the utility came in, and if we use NSTAR in this example, and the NSTAR said, here's the contract we have for gas, and then they would get that gas contract approved, and then when the gas goes through, it goes through their gas cost adjustment, which we do review invoices and things of that nature to ensure that they're passing those through correctly. But the commission would review and then either approve, or the commission has the ability to investigate if it was something that was really, if it was something that the commission felt that they needed to further investigate. And that's where we then suspend for investigation, which is where some of those longer timelines come into play.
Okay, thank you. I'm just trying to understand, because there was a big, big discussion about how much LNG might cost. Mm-hmm. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that line of questioning. I kind of want to just see if I'm getting this properly. My understanding from just what I know and from what you said, Ms. Alvey, to the chair, is that RCA does not have any hand really on the commercial transaction before it reaches a regulatory point. You know, if someone wants to buy in the spot market, they can do that. But you do take it into consideration when you consider how to set the prices, the regulated prices for utilities that buy that gas. So, again, you don't regulate what happens in the commercial market, but you do consider it when that enters the system and becomes part of a regulated utility. Is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, so it will come through either in the contract that we're approving or, well, it's the contract, and then we review those costs as they also pass through the filings. As far as how the market sets that price, that's not.
And when you say through the chair, when you say the contracts, which contracts between who and whom?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the gas contracts between the producer or whoever is providing the gas to the utility. Okay. Those contracts will come in and be approved.
You do approve. Okay.
Okay. Thanks for returning, Representative Rauscher. And Representative Rauscher has some questions for you, Ms. Alvey.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you very much. So, through the chair, I was hoping that we could get some information for the committee when this information is found out. So the questions are, how many PCNs at this time are not billed? What are their needed duties as to what they were hired for, and how long has each PCN position been vacant? And there's a purpose behind it all. It's not just, I'm not trying to cut the budget, trust me. So it's got to do with fiscal notes and stuff like that for the future. So if you could give us that information, I appreciate it.
You may not have it today, Ms. Alvey, but you could get back to us.
Chair McKay, yes, I'd have to get back to exactly how many positions are unfilled and then how long those have been unfilled.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any Representative Sadler?
I will put a fine point, sir, to that same point. I was going to ask the question, you know, if this was an 8-cylinder engine, how many cylinders is RCA operating on? A better way to say is, what percentage are you operating on? 85% of 100? And whatever estimation you might have. And then the real serious question is it impinging or impeding your ability to do the work you need to do? I think that's the underlying question. A lot of us were asking about staffing and vacancies. I mean, is it making it so RCA cannot do the work it's supposed to do or not? And so to what extent?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know the percentage off the top of my head. The commission has continued to work to do our work even with the number of vacancies that we have. I know for within the advisory section, sometimes that does mean that staff has more filings than they have potentially in the past. We are still continuing to go through our proceedings. I mean, we have a number of proceedings before us right now, and still review filings within our statutory regulatory timelines.
Okay, Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, thank you for coming and giving us a primer today. We've got more, I think, to get into here and having some basics for how the RCA is set up and works, and for gas storage is important. And Mr. Chair, I'm looking forward to an additional meeting, and we can get a little deeper into these Cook Inlet energy issues and how that different scenarios and how that decisions are made and how that'll end up affecting utility customers and to what degree that'll affect utility customers. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee for Ms. Alvey? Okay. Seeing none, we want to thank Ms. Alvey for being here. We appreciate the presentation and entertaining our questions. RCA doesn't come in here very much, so it seems like maybe there's a lot of, what do they do, you know, kind of thing. Probably a little curiosity there, if you know what I mean. So thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing you again, and we'll be in contact with you. So I'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Okay, I'd like to call the House Resources Committee back to order, and now we will take up House Bill 359, the one-time PFD payment bill. We bring the bill back before the committee. This is our third House Resources hearing on the bill, and we would like to adopt a committee substitute. So, Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Okay, back on the record, and we are looking at a committee substitute adoption for House Bill 359. And Representative Rauscher, please continue with your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill number 359, Resources, also referred to as 33-LS1292, /B.
Objection. We have an objection. Representative Mears, would you like to describe your objection?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if folks have read the CS, but it basically takes the one-time payment and splits it over into 3 years. It addresses some concerns about people taking the money and run, but I think we need more discussion, and I'd be open to this motion again later today. But
I'm going to have my staff describe the changes.
It's not just the changes, but the discussion on the policy and how that would affect
it. You want to hear the changes?
I think we need a larger discussion in the committee before it
does. Well, that's okay, but would you like to hear the changes first? Okay, keep your objection in place. Mr. Jepson, would you please come forward and describe the summary of the changes for the committee substitute?
Thank you, Chair McKay. For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Chair McKay. And also just to touch on the discussion, Representative Mears was just talking about, we do have Representative Kronk's staff and Cody Rice, policy analyst from the Speaker's office, to discuss that as well after we do the changes. So the first change is in the title. The reference to a one-time PFD payout is removed because now, as Representative Mears stated, there's three payments over the course of 3 years, $5,000 each. The reference to the land voucher is also removed from the title, as that piece of the legislation is no longer included in the committee substitute. Section 1 removes the original Section 1 from HB 359 Version A regarding that permanent fund dividend land voucher, and replaces it with a slightly modified version of HB 359 Section 2, which is just conforming language to account for the three PFD payouts instead of the one-time payout. I'd also reference it as a buyout program instead of a one-time payout. Section 2 is an amended version of HB 359 Version A Section 3, which once again is conforming language for the three $5,000 payments, or referred to as a buyout instead of just the one-time PFD payout. Section 3, once again, more conforming language from HB 359 Version A Section 4, just to reflect the three-year buyout program. And there is no changes in Section 4. It's the same as Section 5 in the original version of the bill. Thank you, Chair McKay.
Okay, Representative Mears, does that help answer your questions?
Mr. Chair, I understand the changes, but the implications of them and the policy decisions from that, I think we need more of a discussion. I'm not sure this helps make the bill better.
Okay, do you maintain your objection?
I maintain my objection.
Okay, Justin, would you please call the roll for the adoption of the committee substitute?
Representative Armstrong.
No.
Representative Mears.
No.
Representative Diver.
No.
Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Representative Baker.
Yes.
Representative Rauscher.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wright.
Yes.
And Chair McCabe.
Yes. Okay, with a vote of 6 yeas and 3 nays, the committee substitute has been adopted. So what I'd like to do now is, Representative Mears, if you'd like to maybe describe your issues so that everyone can understand them, and then maybe we could address them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I still have concerns about this bill, its implications, how we'll implement it, how it will affect Alaskans, our economics and our choices. I understand there might be more of that coming from staff. I appreciate reconsideration of the land component, because I'm not sure that that would be an equitable solution and workable for everyone. But I'm not sure that moving this from a single payment to 3 years with an additional, PFD payouts along the way makes much of a difference in the calculus for folks that would be taking the money and running. It would also be a different calculus for folks that are looking for this payout to purchase a house or a vehicle or do some of those other investments. So I'm not quite sure what 3 years gets us over one.
Okay, well, I think Representative Mears, what I'd like to do now is call Representative Kronk's staff and perhaps Cody Rice to the table, because I'm certainly not able to answer those questions. These gentlemen may be able to answer those questions, or they at least need to hear the feedback so that they can take them into account for potential inclusion in the bill. So, gentlemen, would you please state your name for the record and respond to Representative Mears, if you would?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kronk, sponsor of HB 359.
Cody Rice, staff to the House Majority.
Okay, would you like to respond to Representative Mears' statements or at a later date?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kronk. Very legitimate concerns, no doubt. No one knows exactly when it comes to lump sum payments versus payments over time, what part of the demographic is going to benefit, what part of the demographic is not. I'm 74 years old. Maybe I don't want to bet on another 10 years. Maybe I want to take a lump sum or a larger sum and get out of the program, or a young family who is making an investment in a home or land or maybe college education. So there's some arguments to be made. None of those so far can completely erase people who will just take it because they want a lot of money right now. These are the same people that maybe will go out and get a loan based on a paycheck type of thing, where they know they're going to lose money in the end, but they want money to spend up front. So these things are not ever cleanly understood and defined. In the CS before you, we have the metrics that may answer some questions and cause the committee members to think of scenarios that play out with these particular metrics. One of the guiding aspects of these changes was, how will the state treasury or any part of the state treasury respond to a massive run if everybody said, I want my $15,000 now and out? Legitimate concern. And if you can't require constitutionally that people have been here a certain number of years, and you can't bet that they're not going to come up, move up like Papa Pilgrim with 12 kids, wife, get all that money and leave, what can you do? Well, spreading the money out a little further seems to alleviate. So we're looking for a compromise in there somewhere. So Representative Kronk asked Cody to come up with metrics that ease the burden on the Treasury and make it possible to satisfy the demands of those who feel that they want these installments and say, I will never have the PFD again forever, and I mean it. So that's where we're at. So I think the metrics next, Mr. Chairman, if you can, Cody Rice.
Yeah, Mr. Rice, would you show us your data, please?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Cody Rice, staff to the House Majority, for the record. At the direction of Representative Kronk and in discussion with the chairman's staff, what I did was put together a very simple model of the permanent fund, the dividend, the balance, the statutory net income, and what we have in the top portion in columns U to AB is some of the basic assumptions. So we assumed a $15,000 payout. We assumed 30% of the eligible dividend qualifiers elected to take that buyout. I used balance growth, meaning the balance of the permanent fund, and statutory net income as a percentage of that balance based on figures that the Alaska Permanent Fund publishes themselves and historical averages. So, for example, total balance growth per the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation on average from 2023 to 2033 was 3.12%. That's what I'm using for balance growth. Statutory net income on a going forward basis was assumed by the Permanent Fund Corporation to be 6.03%. So I've used that carried forward as well. And as you can see in columns Z to AB, the NPV 10, the net present value at a 10% discount rate for the current value of the permanent funds going forward is $40,219. The value under the new program would be $39,452 for a difference of just under 2%. So in the first year of the program, the difference in a permanent fund for the average person would be, I think over the next 3 years, we'd average $26 per person lower. This model is dynamic, and I'm happy to share it with the committee members. So if you want to put in different percentages, different assumptions, it will all flow through here. The one caveat I will mention is it does not cap you. So if you assume 100% payout, that's going to be more than we have in cash reserves. I think the limit on the buyout percentage is around 50% without getting into the corpus of the fund itself. And that, of course, depends on budgetary decisions made in this legislature and future legislatures.
Okay, Representative Armstrong.
Thank you to the chair, to Mr. Rice. When we first heard this bill, I brought up behavioral economics and the fact that we see from lottery winners that something between 70 and 90% of people choose a lump sum payment. And I think what I just heard you say is that if more than 50% shows, we'd be going into the corpus. Is that correct?
Through the chairman, Representative Armstrong, both of those things are correct. Typically speaking, discount rates vary for people. I think the simplest way to put it is time preference. The lottery payouts can be complicated as well because of potential tax considerations and people's different life situations. Generally, a discount rate of around 10% is reasonable for businesses. What we see in private lives can vary substantially. And a way of thinking about that is credit cards, right? So a credit card interest rate might be 20% these days. And the fact that someone carries a balance on a credit card implies that their discount rate or their preference for money today versus tomorrow is at least that discount rate. Academic literature is pretty robust on this, but it's hard to pick a single number. 10% is a generally acceptable figure that people use.
Follow-up, Representative Armstrong.
Thank you. Through the chair, I might need to zoom out a little bit because without the land portion in here, it's just a PFD bill that we're kind of hearing now. And so I'm kind of just coming back to why, like what's the thesis of why this is a good idea compared to the status quo? If you could just kind of jog my memory of, I read the original sponsor statement, but why is this the path that we're taking? Why is this the best way forward for the PFD and for Alaskans?
To the chair, Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kroth. It's an option. If it was forced upon people like the one that was proposed under, I believe it was then Senator Mackey, Representative Mackey, I believe, where there was no choice, that's different. Representative Kronk, his whole premise said, he said, people are getting worried about the future of the dividend. They're not able to plan on it because of the fiscal situation here. Government and some people in this body and the others would love to see the PFD diminish or go away so it could be used for public purposes that they think are more important to the public than a check. I mean, there are people with those extreme philosophies is what I'm saying. Representative Kronk simply wanted to give people a choice if they want to believe that the PFD will be there and maybe or maybe not, probably not, who knows, in the Constitution, those folks don't have to choose this. This is an option they choose. So then the point that you raised earlier comes up. Who are these people who would be damaging themselves perhaps by taking that money up front and not having the stream on down the line? And Representative Kronk is very aware that you're never going to have a perfectly clean, yeah, this is an absolute, I'll take it or I won't type of person. So to answer your question specifically, options for having the PFD now in a larger amount versus counting on it in the future. And it's He just wanted a choice out there.
Okay, I think kind of agree with Representative Armstrong. If we're just talking about money and finance and the PFD, this is belongs more in the Finance Committee realm, I would think. But Representative Mears had a question.
Thank you, through the chair. So PFD payouts and like the energy rebate have got different federal tax implications. Would this payout be subject to federal tax, income tax?
I mean, it's my understanding that it would be, but I am not a tax attorney.
Either am I, and that's a question that I will try to get answered for you. Dave Stancliffe with Representative Cronk, sorry.
Apologies to the chair, Cody Rice, staff of the House Majority.
Okay, both testifiers declined to answer.
We can find an expert somewhere.
Okay, Representative Rauscher has a question.
Well, through the chair, I think the intention is to move this out of committee today.
No, actually, we were going to have. Well, what I was planning to do is an amendment deadline next Tuesday, which is over a week, and then set it aside. So
that's all the answer I would need. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Stancliffe. So a couple questions. Well, essentially, the bill allows a person to cash out their right to future PFDs in return for, you know, extra PFDs and double, triple now or over 3 years. My question is, it's not, I've never seen evidence that a permanent fund dividend is transferable. I know they can be garnished, you know, for child support or for library fines, that kind of stuff. But can someone sell the rights to their future PFD on a secondary market? Say I really need cash right now. Could I go someplace and say, I'll sell for $25,000 my right to all future dividends. Can someone do that now? Because that's kind of what this bill does.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think I don't know that there are limits on securitization of almost anything. You can see that with recording artists' royalties. You can see all sorts of things have been securitized. I think there are professional sports players that have securitized parts of their future salaries.
Follow-up, capitalists being creative, you know, there might be some kind of, so does this $5,000 each year for 3 years, $15,000, does that reflect any such securitization on a secondary market?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, again, Cody Rice, staff of the House Majority. I'm not sure what you mean. This wouldn't be a secondary market. This would be the government essentially acting as a secondary market for that right to receive the permanent fund payout in the future.
Follow up,
Representative Sadler.
I'll widen the aperture a little bit. How did you pick $15,000 over 3 years? Why not 50? Why not 100? Why not 10? Is it just a by guess and by gosh number?
Through the chair. Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Cronk. Actually, there's a lot of discussion as to going as high as $22,500, $20,000. The 15 seemed to hit a range. And Cody covered it here, where you're not going to have a super effect on people who continue with the PFD. You're going to have the best possible effect for the state to deal with those who cash out. And as an aside, now that the land portion is out of this particular bill, which was DNR, therefore something the committee should decide on and has decided on, these questions will be put to a much greater extent in finance, I'm sure, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Rauscher has a question, and then I'll try to wrap it up.
Okay, thank you. I was just wondering, on a regular PFD, every year, we have an option to click, pick, or give. There's always the people who believe that there's a chance to help organizations, education, whatever. Will that ever apply to this particular buyout with the money that you receive? Or how does that work? And if it doesn't work, that's all I needed to know.
Through the chair, Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Cronk. The effort was to make sure that everything that pertained to the PFD, including pick, click, and give, stay available until they are completely out of the program and have taken their total amount, and then they're out of everything having to do with the PFD and no longer come under its umbrella or thumb, whichever way you want to put it.
A follow-up,
Representative Rauscher?
Yes.
Pardon?
That was a yes?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would just like to say that I actually agree with Representative Mears that there's still some vagary here. And I did want to get the CS adopted so we'd have something to work on, Representative Mears, just so you know that. But I do agree. I think the next time we hear the bill and resources, come to us with a specific question or decision that you want us to make that relates to resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tell me if anybody thinks I'm incorrect, but tell us what you want us, this committee, to do. And then what I would say is we should move it out. I assume the next committee referral is finance, I think.
Yes. Yes, Mr.
So let's find out what you want us to do. And then we would do that and then move it to finance, because I think a lot of this is better served in finance. Any comments? Does everybody agree with that? Generally, Representative Mears?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all sit in the House and we'll be weighing these decisions. And I think we have a lot of unanswered questions that we've got more capacity to deal with here in resources than finance would. Perhaps a discussion with the Speaker, and if there's another committee that might be a better committee other than finance. But there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm really reluctant to move bills out of committee, even if they're not wholly substantive here.
Well, why don't you write your questions down, write them all down, and we'll distribute them to the committee and to the staff, and then they can work on them. So we're not just sort of winging it, you know, using committee time to brainstorm.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
All right. Any other questions on this bill? All right. So the amendment deadline was going to be for Tuesday, April 2nd at 4 p.m. I'll leave that in place, but I'll extend it if we need to. I look forward to receiving a list of questions from Representative Mears. And in the meantime, I'll set the bill aside. Okay. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 27th at 1 p.m. And seeing no further business before us, we are adjourned at 2:30 p.m. Thank you.